Thanks for being here. I want to begin with an apology about this stupid title that I gave to this. I had only about a week to give a title, and I had no idea what I was going to talk about, on reflection. And I thought, well, it's bound to be about that, but actually it's not much about that. I mean, there's a lot of reflection, but not much reflection about reflection, so so it's misleading. So, you know, if you look at the various titles of Dewey Lectures, they usually have things like My Journey, or, you know, My How It Was, or A Life of Philosophy, or something like that. And I thought I could come up with something a little more interesting, but I failed to do that. So, but what I'm going to do, though, is exactly what David suggested, namely speak of the philosophical and, to some extent, cultural encounters that shape my specific trajectory. I'm afraid this doesn't amount to a broad reflection on philosophy in America. It's certainly going to be autobiographical, perhaps in excess, but at least it's a view from the point of view of one person who fell in love with philosophy very early. But to see what philosophy means to me, I'm going to begin with a few reflections about my quite early life. I hope this doesn't seem too self-indulgent, but we actually need a violin section here for the, but it apparently wasn't in the budget. But the first 8 years of my life, my older brother and I were raised by my single mother with help from my grandparents. It didn't matter to us that we lived in a ramshackle house in a low rent neighborhood, for it had an apple tree in the backyard from the top of which my brother and I could see the Olympic Mountains. And we lived a half a block from the shores of Puget Sound and with its endless treasures of driftwood and sea glass, kelp, and clamshells. Then my mother married my stepfather, beginning what was to become a disastrously dysfunctional relationship. We moved 9 times before I was a sophomore in high school. And each time meant a change of school and a dislocation of social relationships. And the mobility wasn't because my parents were diplomats or military or missionaries. They were just running away from one or another foreclosure or other similar thing. So this pattern left my brother and me in a fragile state, a sense of being on the fringe of things, a sense of insecurity and social anxiety that I must admit plagues me somewhat still. The injuries of class are not entirely or even mainly material, but have largely to do with feeling diminished by a dominant culture. One's inferior socioeconomic circumstances might be literally worn on one's ragged sleeve or displayed by the rattletrap car one's parents drove, but it's often possible to hide or escape one's class by walking to the school dance or avoiding having certain perhaps would-be friends over to one's chaotic residence, or eventually by moving up the social economic ladder. But the sense of diminishment and insecurity can itself be felt keenly long after one's cultural and material circumstances have elevated. One's often burdened by a feeling of having something to hide, and the only people it feels possible to befriend are those who are similarly wounded. A close enough depiction of my cultural milieu, and here I wish we had a little streaming, can be found in the 1955 movie Rebel Without a Cause, which perfectly captured the foreboding atmosphere of the self-destructive anomie in which I lived my teenage years. James Dean's character was admittedly cooler than I was, except in my fantasies. And unlike me, he had a hot rod, which I couldn't afford, as well as a girlfriend who looked a lot like Natalie Wood. But the scene in reality was fraught with danger, a feeling that anyone could do something crazy at any time, including myself, and we sometimes did. Now, I can't claim that I ever fully escaped the sense of cultural or social insecurity. It's been in some ways handicapping, but it's had its positive side, because I felt keenly attuned to the disadvantages of social class and other prejudices and disadvantages that I perceived around me, and became aware of the role of luck rather than merit that came to separate me from many others I grew up with, including some of those in my family. It left me, though, with, I think, what might be called a kind of survivor's guilt. Now, with the exception of a dear uncle, no one in my family had gone to college. I suppose it would be a continuum of high school, which I loathed. So I never considered it. Instead, I worked here and there, hitchhiked around the country with friends for a while. I'd always been a fairly avid but almost completely untutored reader who enjoyed novels and thinking about current moral and political issues. During my later teenage years, I stumbled on Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, which strongly affected me, and Thoreau's Walden Pond. The defiant tone and libertarian individualism of Ayn Rand's novels had some initial adolescent appeal, but her outlook had a bad smell overall to me, with its contempt for blue-collar folks and labor unions. Above all, I was repelled by its disparagement of altruism, as she called it, and community as weakness. It seemed heartless to me. So I drifted around in this way for a while when I had what I took to be a life-changing experience. For several months, I'd been working swing shift in a box factory. One evening after the bus dropped me off down the street from the job site, I found that I couldn't bring myself to enter the factory. My epiphany was that I couldn't go on with my life as it was. And instead, I took the next bus downtown to a residential hotel where a friend of mine had once stayed. I used what money I had to rent a room there for the next 3 weeks. And on the one hand, this impulsive act made no sense at all. I didn't like my job or my life in general, but the box factory paid a good wage. I had no alternative job prospects, so it seemed indefensibly irresponsible. And yet, it was translucently clear to me that I was doing the right thing. I wanted to be a writer, and to do so, I had to break away. This decision seemed to me both mysterious and liberating, and the fact that it felt liberating I took as some sort of validation. Indeed, it had the character for me of a kind of conversion experience without religious content. It felt like a rebirth, a casting off of shackles, a point of no return, and so to some extent it was. I set out to become a writer, and in a fashion that I couldn't at the time imagine, a writer of sorts I would become. Before my 3 weeks of rent had been exhausted, the manager of the hotel offered me a part-time job as a desk clerk in exchange for room and board. While I lived at the hotel, I was fortunate enough to become acquainted with a collective of young artists in Seattle who introduced me to poetry, music, painting, in which I was until then more or less entirely unversed. I had encountered Ginsberg, Kerouac, Gary Snyder, but my new friends also discussed Rilke, Marianne Moore, Hesse, Nietzsche, and Eastern philosophy and religion. It was stimulating and seductive company. Among this group was a philosophy major. It was awesome news to me that there was such a university subject. And largely due to these encouraging associations, college now made sense. Indeed, it became urgent. Since my high school record was so poor, the path to the University of Washington began across the mountains at a community college in Yakima Valley. As it turned out, this was by no means a bad thing. Instruction in literature and composition was excellent, and there I made a lifelong friend and moral and intellectual exemplar, Alan Drinkson, my first philosophy instructor, now retired at the University of Victoria. I hankered to get back to a more comprehensive and lively urban campus and transferred the next year to the University of Washington. But my year in Yakima Valley gave me a discipline for academic work and an appreciation for the community college as a distinctive American institution, offering students inexpensive access to talented faculty and a second chance for those like me who had more or less squandered their high school years. To continue the quasi-religious metaphor, I was looking for the promised land and in the university, I found it. My undergraduate years were altogether a sort of awakening, as significant as the childhood transformation to literacy must have been. I discovered that the physical and cultural world had meanings that I could now read for the first time. I loved it all, history, biology, astronomy, especially literature and literary theory. Eventually, I declared a major in philosophy because I supposed that what drew me to literature was philosophical questions anyway. I now think that's probably only partly true. Similarly, I entertained the idea of going to law school upon graduation, but since my interest in law, again, was primarily philosophical, going on in philosophy seems to make the most sense. I learned a great deal from a number of philosophy faculty at the university, but the two who had the biggest impact on my education were James Smith, who taught me political philosophy and philosophy of law, and the mysterious and charismatic Frederick Siegler, who taught me philosophy of action and moral psychology. It was in Siegler's courses, in which he himself was working out his own ideas, that I made the subtle transition from being a mere student of philosophy to practicing philosophy, by which I mean reading and writing philosophy with some sense, however tenuous, of the issues, and with something, however rudimentary, I wanted to say in my own voice. This is not a transition at all to being a good philosopher, of course, but a transition to being a philosopher at all, one that some good philosophy majors never managed to make. And in my experience, it's this point at which philosophy really takes hold of one. Both Siegler and Jim Smith encouraged me to apply to graduate school. And when I considered the prospect, I had virtually no sense of entering a profession or career. I merely wanted or needed more. Going down the road to the University of Oregon seemed a good idea to me. I liked Oregon. But my advisors urged me to apply more widely. In addition to some familiar names on the East Coast, Jim Smith urged me to consider Rockefeller University, which I hadn't even heard of. Jim had studied under Joel Feinberg at Brown, and Feinberg had just joined the Rockefeller faculty. His connection must have had some impact, since Rockefeller invited me to Manhattan for a campus visit. As far as I know, it was not common back in those days for graduate programs to pay the expenses for campus visits for students they had admitted. But what was really unusual about this invitation was that it was to include an interview with the president of the university, Detlev Bronk, to determine whether I was worthy of admission. I bought what I took to be suitable attire for such a visit and flew to New York City. It was my first airplane flight, the first airplane flight of my life. I had encouraging visits with several graduate students and faculty there, including Sidney Shoemaker, Joel Feinberg, and Harry Frankfurt. Michael Bratton was, I think, there at the time, but I don't know that I met him. But evidently, the interview with President Bronk didn't go very well. By the time I got back to Seattle, I was informed that I wasn't admitted. Bronk had pressed me during the interview about whether my primary interest in political philosophy and philosophy of law wouldn't be better served at a comprehensive university. Rockefeller was a sort of institute of science with philosophy the only, humanities and social science discipline. This is a good question. What puzzled me, though, was not that I was rejected, but that I was rejected for that reason, because after all, it was up front on my application. That was my primary interest, and they brought me out knowing that. So it seemed something unbelievably extravagant about paying all that money for information that they could have gotten by looking at the application. So I suspected it must have been something else, and perhaps my bargain basement jacket was. But I was puzzled but not disappointed, because I had already been admitted by several good departments, including Princeton. Now, quaint and pretty as it was, and still is, I found the town of Princeton exceedingly conceited. Perhaps there was an element of class defensiveness in this judgment, but the graduate program at Princeton, which is what I was there for, turned out to be much to my liking. If my undergraduate years were years of intellectual and cultural metamorphosis, my graduate education was a more or less total immersion in a discipline. With all that that means, I was culturally intimidated by some of the fancy backgrounds of many, though by no means all, of my peers. For example, the Exeter, Amherst, and Princeton trajectory. But I felt no condescension from them. It was a tribute to our shared seriousness about philosophical questions, I think. And my lowbrow background didn't matter that much. My companions in this enterprise, from whom I learned so much of what it means to be a philosopher and to be held philosophically accountable, included Michael Friedman, David Hills, Terry Irwin, Ed Hartman, Tyler Burge, Richard Kraut, Mary Gibson, Kathy Wilkes, Philip Kitcher, Arthur Kurflik, Patricia Williams, Michael Williams, Alexander Nehemos, Kathleen Cook, Jay Atlas, and others. These were exciting years to be at Princeton. I had memorable seminars and independent studies with Carl Hempel, Gregory Vlastos, Richard Brody, Gilbert Harmon, and Tim Scanlon, Thomas Nagel, Stuart Hampshire, Walter Kaufman, and George Pitcher, and Donald Davidson. I also worked with some notable visiting faculty, including Feinberg, who came down from Rockefeller, Jonathan Bennett, and David Gautier. And in addition, the department hosted many exciting intellectual events. For example, Saul Kripke gave his thrilling lectures on naming and necessity for the first time in Princeton in 1970. Philippa Foot delivered her important paper, Morality as a System of Hypothetical Imperatives, around the same time. Many of the faculty were also producing groundbreaking work in philosophy of mind, language, and ethics, work which was widely read and debated by graduate students. Thomas Nagel's The Possibility of Altruism appeared around this time. This, in my opinion, profound and elegant book had a deep and lasting effect on the way I viewed moral psychology and practical reasons. Luckily, Nagel, who became one of my philosophical heroes, also became my supervisor for my thesis. One lively set of debates during this period, raised particularly by Hempel's prominent deductive nomological theory of scientific explanation, centered around the possibility of human sciences. To what extent does human rationality prevent the human sciences from being nomological? This question arises both for individuals and societies. The notion of rule involved the understanding of human societies as rule-governed. It's not the notion of regularity, but of a critical normative standard. This point also figured centrally in Herbert Hart's analysis of legal systems and the concept of law, which required rules accepted from an internal point of view. Some writers, such as Peter Winch at this time, were led to question the very idea of a social science. Winch was inspired by Wittgenstein in some way, but the debate also incorporated Weber's notion of Verstehen as a distinctive style of explanation that aimed at interpretation rather than prediction. And surprisingly, these conceptions of explanation found some support in Davidson's theory of anomalous monism at the time. I think that in some version or another, these issues are still with us. The philosophy faculty seemed to me friendly and accessible to graduate students, though I'm not sure all of my classmates felt the same way. There were frequent social respites from the normal intense immersion in our studies. Many faculty who lived near the university regularly had students to their homes for discussions or other get-togethers. My first spring, there was a softball game with mixed teams of students and professors. It was great fun, if also slightly alarming, to see the professors at play. When Davidson was at bat, a fellow graduate student, Ed Hartman, hilariously quipped, "Logical form, yes. Batting form, no." Davidson didn't seem amused. The graduate students themselves occasionally organized softball games and picnics of their own. One of these games pitted the Quinians against the Strawsonians. The litmus test was one's endorsement or rejection of the analytic synthetic distinction. I played for the Strawsonians. As a further respite, sherry parties in the Tower Room of 1879 Hall were replaced or supplemented for many of us by pop parties. But there are other more significant distractions from scholarly life. I entered graduate school in 1968, 50 years ago. These were ominous and tumultuous times, politically and culturally. It was the year of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and of the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. The urban riots in Newark the year before underscored the extent to which American apartheid and its legacy was not just a Southern problem. In August of that summer, the riotous Democratic National Convention further divided the Democratic Party from its traditional base. This divide appeared in my own family, many of whom, despite my pleas, were about to vote for a Republican for the first time. That fall, Richard Nixon was narrowly elected. The segregationist candidate, George Wallace, carried 7 Southern states. The tumult of those times was, of course, felt on many campuses, even Princeton's, though not to the extent to which it appeared other places. Most of the graduate students and faculty were naturally involved to some degree or another with the many teach-ins. Protests, rallies, and demonstrations focused primarily on the Vietnam War, but also on civil rights issues, including an awakening concern for gender issues. The Equal Rights Amendment was introduced in Congress, remember, in 1971. I think one welcome consequence of these sorts of intense engagements was to foster more systematic philosophical thinking about social and public policy. There was more thoughtful, informal discussion among graduates and students and faculty of about authority, civil disobedience versus rebellion, violence and brutality, social justice, the grounds for political toleration, and hence free speech. It's unsurprising then that the very first issue of Philosophy and Public Affairs was published by Princeton University Press in autumn 1971. It included 2 articles by Michael Walzer and Richard Wasserstrom, respectively, on the justice of war and on the responsibility of individual citizens for the wars fought by their countries, in addition to Judy Thompson's defense of abortion. These were followed in the next issue by seminal essays by 2 of the founding associate editors of the journal, Nagel's Warren Massacre and Tim Scanlon's A Theory of Freedom of Expression. Now, you will have noticed something conspicuous in the stellar lineup of the Princeton faculty I've mentioned. There were no women philosophy faculty at Princeton during the years in which I was doing coursework. The same was true when I was an undergraduate at the University of Washington. Indeed, until the fall of 1969, there were only 3 women in the professorial ranks across all fields at the university. Margaret Wilson joined the Princeton department in the early 70s, shortly before I left, so I didn't get a chance to take a course with her. In this connection, it should be noted that Emily Rorty was at this time a stimulating presence on the Princeton intellectual scene. And also bear in mind that like other Ivy League schools, Princeton did not admit undergraduate women until 1969, and then mainly because coeducation was increasingly appealing to the male students that these universities wanted to attract. Fortunately, my classmates included a number of talented women whose productive careers would begin to ameliorate the gender inequality in the profession. As far as I know, women were no longer being explicitly discouraged from seeking a faculty position teaching philosophy after graduate school, a message that was not uncommon for women to hear earlier in the decade. Of course, in addition to the sheer paucity of women in the profession, there were plenty of discouraging insinuations. To give just a really minor illustration, the faculty member who gave the orientation to my first year class prior to the beginning of the semester described certain features of the Princeton graduate program, for example, the first term great man exam, as devices to weed out the weak sisters among us. He seemed oblivious to the slur. I said that my deepest interest as I entered graduate school was in moral and political philosophy, including philosophy of law. Yet I eventually wrote a dissertation on free agency and responsibility. This topic was not as discontinuous with my original interest as might appear. I had long been interested in the idea of human autonomy in political context. Democratic liberalism presumes that citizens are self-governing agents and that idea was under attack from various quarters. At this time, B.F. Skinner's behaviorism, dominated empirical psychology. And Skinner himself articulated what he took to be its implications in two popular books at the time, Walden II and Beyond Freedom and Dignity. The challenges to this conception also came from political discourse. According to neo-Marxist critiques, the understanding of human beings as autonomous was part of the false consciousness of bourgeois liberalism. The argument was that capitalist society undermines the possibility of autonomous choice. This contention resounded in the 60s and 70s, not just in academic writing, but in radical political discourse. Herbert Marcuse argued in his 1965 critique of Mill on liberty, a critique called Repressive Tolerance, that the conditions for liberty is self-determination or autonomy, and hence for neutral political tolerance are just not possible in our social and material circumstances. The political task is to fight for the society in which man, I'm quoting now, is no longer enslaved by institutions which vitiate self-determination from the beginning. So it's not, unlike the critique from behaviorism, it's not that self-determination is a confused or idea of an impossibility for human nature. It's rather an ideal that requires social conditions that cannot yet obtain. This challenge that liberalism very much exercised me. But the specific trigger for eventual selection of my dissertation topic was a seminar with Joel Feinberg, who was visiting from Rockefeller. One of the short paper assignments in the course posed the question whether we can make sense of the idea of intrapersonal coercion, of being coerced by one's own desires in a way that's analogous to political coercion. My response to that assignment was the beginning of a central chapter in my dissertation. Thus, my initial engagement with the topic of responsibility had very much to do with autonomy rather than with the blame side of things. This remained a preoccupation in my earliest essays, which stressed the crucial importance of our capacity for evaluative self-government. The exercise of the capacity for evaluative practical thought, which constituted our autonomy, also opened it up to moral criticism in various forms of praise and blame. But the autonomy was primary. My dissertation project, by the way, almost came unhinged. One January morning in 1971, when I picked up the latest issue of the Journal of Philosophy and discovered, as I thought, that Harry Frankfurt had totally scooped the conception of free agency that I was developing in my thesis. As soon as I could arrange a meeting, I revealed this calamity to my thesis advisor, Tom Nagel. Nagel hadn't yet read Frankfurt's article, but he calmly talked me down from the ledge. Thanks to our talk, it seemed that important differences remained, particularly having to do with my conception of the relation of values and desires. One of the mothers of invention, it turns out, is the necessity of salvaging your dissertation. And I eventually sent a draft of the revised chapter to Frankfurt, who was graciously encouraging, though quite skeptical. The spring of my fourth year, I abbreviated my job search early to accept a one-year visiting position at Reed College, in the vain hope that it would somehow lead to a more permanent position in the Pacific Northwest, for which I was and remained homesick. Graduate student teaching at Princeton was more or less noblesse oblige. I had only to teach only three semesters with no teaching instruction whatever, so I wasn't very good at it. It took me years to feel reasonably comfortable in the classroom, both for this reason and for a long life propensity for performance anxiety. The reteaching was demanding, but the students were remarkably good, in retrospect as good as any I have taught. After Steve Jobs died, a journalist called to ask if I had any memory of Jobs when he took a philosophy course that I taught. And I hadn't realized that he had enrolled in any of my courses. I didn't remember him at all. I learned then that Jobs had dropped out of Reed before the end of the first semester. And perhaps I can take some consolation from the possibility that my uninspiring teaching prompted him to embark on his revolutionary career. By the time my year at Reed came to an end, no other prospects in the region had materialized. Unfortunately, I received an offer of a regular position at the University of Pennsylvania and returned to the East Coast. I published a couple of pieces for my dissertation during the Penn years, but much of my attention during this time was captured by Rawls and by Kant's moral and political philosophy. The theory of justice has circulated for a few years in manuscript before being published very close to the end of my Princeton years. But I don't recall any graduate offerings on Kant's ethics during that period. These interests in Kant's ethics and in theory of justice were related in as much as Rawls himself stressed and seemed at the time to favor the so-called Kantian interpretation of justice as fairness. Furthermore, in addition to his book, Xerox copies of Rawls' extraordinary handwritten lecture commentary on the groundwork, Kant's groundwork, came into my hands around the same time. And to me, these were mind-blowing. They were breathtakingly illuminating. Kant's studies at the time was also fueled by some excellent work by Honora O'Neill, who had been a student of Rawls, Alan Wood, and others in the mid-70s. And later flowered in the hands of Barbara Herman and Christine Korsgaard, who were also students of Rawls. My Kantian studies continued into the 80s after I moved to Irvine. I wrote several essays on Kant during this time, only one of which I published. My interest in theory of justice, though, went beyond political philosophy proper. Rawls himself encouraged the more general idea of rightness and as fairness, not just so that justice as fairness is merely a political application of a more general contractualist theory of morality. Something like this eventually received expression in Tim Scanlon's work and came to command much of my attention thereafter. A third area of interest during this period was philosophy of action, and especially issues posed by Anscombe and Davidson. One of the highlights of the Penn Department those days were the annual visits as adjunct professors by Elizabeth Anscombe and Peter Geach. They were, to be sure, formidable figures. Anscombe was known to be temperamental about any topic to do with Aristotle, Aquinas, Wittgenstein, or religion. But I managed to have rather good philosophical exchanges with her on issues involving act individuation and trying. Her seminars, which I attended whenever I could, were a great pleasure. They had the same character as her writings, utterly original, insightful, and elusive. Richard Jeffrey was department chair when I arrived, but unfortunately Penn lost Jeffrey to Princeton the year after. Happily, a smart and lively group of junior faculty and postdocs provided stimulating company. They included Scott Weinstein, Mark Sagoff, Ed Hartman, James Garson, Michael Friedman, Janet Levin, Richard Warner, and Ruth Mattern. For complicated reasons, from my point of view, the atmosphere in the Penn Department while I was there was troubled. There were long-standing feuds between powerful full professors, and the relations between the junior and senior faculties were strained. For one thing, by and large, assistant professors felt unsupported. For another, they felt excluded by the closed-door decisions of their senior colleagues, and even those who managed to get tenure felt that their support had been begrudging and delayed. So as a result, Penn failed to retain a number of gifted philosophers over that decade of the 70s and early 80s. And for these and personal reasons, I decided to accept an offer from the University of California at Irvine, where I spent the next 20 years of my life. The position I took up at Irvine was made possible by the retirement of Abe Meldon, who was appointed to develop the Irvine program in the mid-60s. I already knew his work and some of the other faculty, and it seemed like a good place for me to be. In particular, Meldon's work on free action had figured in my dissertation. Fortunately, Meldon maintained a significant presence in the department until his death in 1991, so I was able to get to know him. Davidson's criticisms in Actions, Reason, and Causes of Meldon's well-known arguments against the causal theory of action explanation were widely thought to be devastating. Naturally, Meldon was stung by this reception, and he seemed happy to learn that I myself had some sympathy for his non-causal theory. I still do. It was never clear to me, however, whether Meldon himself had anything to say by way of reply to Davidson. I never could get it out of him. Another department member whose work I admired since graduate school was Jerry Santis, who's insightful papers on the Socratic paradox, you know, that is that no one does wrong voluntarily, were a great help to me in my work on weakness of will. I was happy to become his colleague and soon his friend. In the first few years of my arrival, the department made several transformative senior appointments, which would include leadership in the department for, provide leadership in the department for decades. These included Terry Parsons, Greg Kafka, Brian Skirms, and a bit later, Penn Matty. There was also an impressive number of junior faculty who came through, including Sally Haslanger and Christian Mercer, and Alan Nelson, and David Espen. The appointment of Greg Kafka early in my days at Irvine was especially important to me philosophically and personally. Kafka and I were both attracted to contractualism, or contractarianism as he called it, but of markedly different sorts. In addition to his brilliant work on the paradoxes of nuclear deterrence and his discovery of the famous toxin puzzle, Kafka was establishing himself as one of the leading Hobbes scholars. He aimed to work out a version of moral and political contractualism on Hobbesian lines. The guiding aim is to explain moral requirements as somehow rooted in prudential rationality. This aim was conjoined with the suspicion that without that grounding, moral rationality would be in jeopardy. What Kafka called the Reconciliation Project aimed to show how basic moral requirements are compatible with the rational advantage of those subject to them. The presumption was that unless we can show this, moral skepticism is warranted. In contrast, I joined Rawls and Scanlon, whose seminal paper, Utilitarianism and Contractualism, appeared in 1980, and in thinking that such a grounding was neither possible nor necessary, and in wanting to make a distinction between the rational and the reasonable. I took it that Nagel had shown in The Possibility of Altruism that a proper understanding of prudential rationality undercut the main premise of standard forms of moral skepticism, namely that practical reasons are rooted in present desire. If one's future interests can give us reasons independent of one's present desires, we need a further argument to show that the interests of others cannot do so as well. So I doubted the prioritizing of prudence that fueled the Reconciliation Project. These issues were the occasion for ongoing fruitful discussions, and Greg and I and our families became close friends. We founded a discussion group called the Moral and Political Philosophy Society that for a dozen years or so attracted participants from the Southern California area, hosted many lively exchanges. We sat in on one another's seminars and shared many excellent graduate students, including David Shoemaker. Greg's encouragement, advice, and good humor helped me to cope with many personal and departmental troubles, and he maintained his devotion to his work, his productivity, and his devotion to teaching, despite his own brave struggles with recurring cancer, from which he died 15 years after coming to Irvine. In addition to work on contractualism, I also carried on with my focus on freedom and responsibility. Some of this work was a reaction to Peter Van Inwagen's powerful essay on free will. My colleague Nelson Pike had written important papers on free will in the context of God's foreknowledge, papers which overlapped with many of the issues and arguments by Van Inwagen. During this time, too, I tried to come to terms with Strawson's freedom and resentment, which I understood to be arguing that the capacity for responsibility should be explained by or interpreted by our need to stand in relations of mutual regard with others. This reading of Strawson suggested me for the first time that we should understand the notion of being a responsible agent as being one who's fit to be held to responsibilities. Adapting Rawls' slogan, Strawson was saying that responsibility is social, not metaphysical. In connection with these topics, I was fortunate to have John Fisher and for a very short while, Mark Revisa nearby in Riverside. We met with some regularity, and through Fisher, I became acquainted with a number of the Riverside philosophers. As I'll explain, these relationships made my eventual move to Riverside very attractive and comfortable. Thanks. These were formative years for me pedagogically too, in a way that fed into some of my research. Jerry Santos kindly agreed to teach a seminar with me on Aristotle's ethics, in which I'd had a serious interest since graduate school. Since I didn't know Greek, I had always been reluctant to teach a graduate course by myself, and I never did. But with Santos, we did this twice at the graduate level and once at the undergraduate level. Santos set a high standard of meticulous collaboration, and working with him through the text and recent first-rate secondary literature was a pleasure and an education. My renewed study of Aristotle led to a more general investigation of the role of virtue in moral theory. For some time, I'd been suspicious of the dominant tendency found in Franken and Rawls to define away the possibility of a virtue-centered moral theory. According to that story, the right and the good, understood as choice-worthy outcomes, were the basic moral concepts, virtue being definable in terms of one of them, depending on your view. This seemed to me to leave out Aristotle, or to misclassify him as a perfectionist form of consequentialist. That's how Rawls took him. Thanks to writers such as Foote, James Wallace, and Michael Sloat, the virtues were now getting more attention, leading me to investigate the possibility and plausibility of a moral structure of a third kind, an ethics of virtue, in my article, The Primacy of Character. I chiefly attempted to articulate what such a third kind of ethics would look like, but I also reached a cautiously pessimistic conclusion about its prospects. Nonetheless, I retained a sense that virtue ethics was onto something important, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Alas, to paraphrase Yeats, eventually the center did not hold, and things at Irvine fell apart. A combination of passionate conviction and failure of integrity led a handful of faculty to decamp to a newly and secretly created department of logic and the philosophy of science. Perhaps there were good reasons for this new arrangement. I suspect there were. Perhaps the result has been overall a good one for philosophy at Irvine. In any case, the deception by the leaders of the secession and by the administrators who enabled them, in my view, destroyed the basis for trust and goodwill. I could no longer breathe in that atmosphere, and I left at the first opportunity. And I was fortunate to have the opportunity to move to Irvine, to Riverside, sorry. Now, the discontent in Irvine had superficially to do with the divisions between analytic and continental interest in the department. But as everyone knows, the conceptual distinction between analytic and continental philosophy makes no sense, whatever. The continental divide has a certain social reality, but it's rather like race. We can make rough and ready sense of descriptive, morphological, and ancestral distinctions, but we cannot make sense of the meaning we give to these. But then giving them this meaning creates, in both cases, a significant and pernicious social reality. I've never myself seen any sense to this conflict, and my own exposure to German, not to mention French philosophy after Kant, extremely scant. These areas were largely marginalized or mocked by the departments in which I grew up. For example, on the last day of History of Modern course that I took as an undergraduate with Arthur Smullyan, Smullyan previewed for the students what they would encounter if they went on to study 19th century philosophy. And at this point, he referred to a book called The Secret of Hegel. Suffice it to say, Smullyan told his students, the secret remains tightly held. I merely regarded my ignorance of this range of philosophical texts as one of the many gaps in my education, alongside philosophy of physics and formal semantics and many other things, not something to be proud of. I did read Marx and Engels and authors from the Frankfurt School as a graduate student, and subsequently read quite a lot of Nietzsche and some commentators on Hegel, but that's about all. Now, the fuss about continental analytic philosophy does bring out an important question about the aspirations of our discipline. Perhaps the most common complaint about continental philosophy is that it's indifferent to standards of clarity. Of course, deficiencies in clarity are easy to find on both sides of that alleged divide. Questions about clarity, believe it or not, have even been raised about my own work. I recall an interaction with my friend and Riverside colleague, Georgia Warnke, who works on Gadamer and Habermas. Once we were chatting in the department offices when she made a surprising claim, apropos of what I can't remember, but she said, you know, I think you're the most analytic philosopher in the department. I found that, you know, puzzling because I didn't think I was the least analytic, but there were many, there were more. So I think as that idea is standardly understood. So I said to Georgia, why do you say that? I think it's vainly preparing myself from some sort of compliment from her, perhaps about my conceptual acuity. And she replied, well, because your work is so hard to understand. A very clever turning of the tables, that. Perhaps I should have concluded instead that I must be something of a continental philosopher after all. There's a serious point here. Philosophy aims at some kind of articulate understanding, and any enterprise with that aspiration is committed to standards of clarity and consistency. Clarity is a matter of degree, though, and has different dimensions. A work can be clear sentence by sentence, but what it adds up to may be quite elusive. Philosophy is hard. One question about any piece of difficult philosophy is whether its unclarity is worth it. Is it worth slogging through this text to get it? And people can disagree about this. Some, I think many difficult writers nevertheless strike us, or some of us, if not others, as worth the trouble. One finds insights there, and of course, that can only be so if the text is not simply impenetrable. In my own view, we should be grateful that some among us have a rather higher tolerance for obscurity than others, and are willing to struggle with the inchoate in the hope, not always vain, of shedding some light. They sometimes show that some subjects, after all, permit of more clarity than we'd supposed. Well, being in a congenial department at Riverside was by now, extremely important to me, and I found that at Riverside. It was not only a philosophically first-rate and open-minded faculty, but a much happier family. Philosophy at Riverside also promoted itself, like Irvine had, as a department that accommodates both traditions, continental and analytic, but Riverside seems to me to have pulled it off rather better than Irvine had, at least while I was there. And by that I mean, for the most part, even those who self-identified as analytic had genuine respect for the work of their so-called continental colleagues, and conversely. And this respect showed up in collective action, camaraderie, accommodation, hiring. Moreover, some merely dismiss the idea that they're bridging a gap because they deny that there is a gap there to bridge. The relevant distinction is between better and worse philosophy. More importantly to me, when I was at Riverside, the department was a hotbed for philosophy of human agency and moral psychology. John Fisher had already attracted a cadre of graduate students in free will and responsibility. Paul Hoffman had a long-standing interest in issues of free will and historical figures such as Descartes and Reid. It was in this setting that I started thinking seriously about the will in human agency, prompted by Hoffman and the work of Michael Bratman and Jay Wallace. Andy Reith was an important interlocutor in moral agency and Kant and moral theory in general. Discussions with Peter Graham were of great help in the work I did during these years on assertion, promising, and discursive responsibility. And soon the agency group was joined by Colleen McNamara and Michael Nelson, whose respective interests in moral psychology and metaphysics nicely complemented the other members of the agency group. Riverside was now attracting and training some of the best students in the country in these fields, and it was exhilarating to be involved with this group. Undergraduate teaching at Riverside was also rewarding. The campus had the highest percentage of first-generation college students in the University of California system. This presented challenges, but also opportunities. The experience of college is very often, as we all know, transformative, but the opportunities to deeply affect the lives of students in this population, students such as I had been, are especially great. More often than ever before, I had students who told me afterwards how much an intro to philosophy course had equipped them for the first time to engage with the larger intellectual and cultural life of the country. Now, I want to stop in a moment, and I'm not going to say very much about USC, only because this is my most recent position, and these are mainly historical, historical trajectory. I only want to say that I was attracted to USC because I had an opportunity to have a joint appointment in the law school and pursue my interest in criminal responsibility, which is a kind of perfect fusion of political theory and theory of responsibility for me. It also happens to be the case that the USC department has one of the best philosophical faculties in the world, and it gets better all the time. So it's been a wonderful place to be. But what I'd like to do in conclusion is to say something just of a general kind about how I see my main philosophical preoccupations as fitting together. I identify those preoccupations as two. First, non-consequentialism, and second, the inescapability of responsibility. This seemed to me importantly connected in ways that weren't initially clear to me. Okay, thank you. Yeah, let me know if I start to get inaudible. These concerns with non-consequentialism and in responsibility seemed to me importantly connected in ways that weren't initially clear to me. Now, long been convinced that consequentialism was mistaken, and badly mistaken, and that conviction has animated much of my research and teaching. Though I do confess to having briefly flirted with utilitarianism as an undergraduate, recoiling from W.D. Ross's The Right and the Good, which seemed to me to leave the connection between moral requirements and human well-being purely accidental, except, of course, for the duty of benevolence. Unless the moral life were based on the good in some fundamental way, it couldn't be choice-worthy. It didn't occur to me then that there were non-consequentious ways to accommodate this truth. In graduate school, I was introduced to Aristotle and therefore to the possibility of virtue-based accounts of morality, which are at once teleological and non-consequentialist. Mostly, though, I was swept away by contractualism, which I thought promised some prospect for reconciliation of the right and the good. The challenge is to achieve this reconciliation in a way that recognizes the deep constraints on consequentialist reasoning. The key to accommodation, I came to think, lies in the requirement that authoritative moral principles must be justifiable to individuals in light of their own conceptions of the good. Thus, on contractualist accounts, it's no coincidence that promising, for example, and other constraints on consequentialist reasoning, what Ross called prima facie duties, were in general practices that serve and coordinate the interests and values of the individuals to whom they apply. It then came to seem to me that Kantianism, with its foundation in the conditions of rational agency, was too austere to provide a satisfactory alternative to consequentialism. So, recall I was interested in both consequentialism and Kantianism as alternatives. But came to think consequentialism was superior in this regard. That's a deeply important consideration in favor of contractualism, I think, but it didn't seem to me, still doesn't seem to me, to go deep enough, for it left open the question of moral motivation. Let me explain. What is it about morality as so conceived that made it a good way to live for its own sake? That it is a good way to live is necessary for the moral life to make sense. But the answer cannot appeal to goods that are realized instrumentally. There must be something inherently good in living that way. The answer has to be, it seems to me, that standing in certain relations to others is a preeminent, if not supreme, value. We are back to a variation of Kafka's reconciliation problem, but the project now is not to reduce moral reasons to prudential advantage, individual or collective. people might sensibly care about morality for its own sake, but we tend to think that the object of this concern is not just one value among other attractive alternatives. We tend to think that the neglect of morality is not, at least other things being equal, consistent with a life of flourishing, that to live immorally is to live badly. And here's where the theory of virtue has to come in. I don't know how to tell this story, but I hope in years to come to get a better grip on what the right answer is. That's how I see it now. And here's how I see the tie between non-consequentialism and responsible agency. One way to put Bernard Williams' well-known critique of consequentialism is that consequentialism does violence to the fact that each of us is responsible for our own lives. A related point emphasized by Rawls is that consequentialism lacks an adequate conception of the human person as an agent. Someone with a life to lead has ends of her own, which restricts the claims that she can make against others and that others can make against her. Moral agents are beings with lives of their own from whom it can be expected that they recognize the similar status of others and that they can form their practical lives accordingly. The main aim of a positive theory of responsible agency is to give an account of the competences that are necessary and sufficient for this kind of moral standing. Moral responsibility is, I say, is inescapable for beings with these competences. In my view, however, criticism of all kinds involves responsibility in the basic and familiar sense. Philosophers are responsible for what they write and answerable to their audience for what they publish. This responsibility obtains simply in virtue of the fact that what they write is appraisable and it is theirs. The merits and demerits are, as we say, down to the authors. Of course, there is the question of originality. I might just be parroting others. Originality is, in some contexts, a major dimension of appraisal, a major virtue. If I just repeat an idea of Christine Korsgaard's, its brilliance is not attributable to me. But insofar as I assert it, I too am answerable for it. It is in this limited but fundamental way still mine. It's mine by my accepting it, not by originating it. Responsibility in this basic sense seems to me at the heart of reason itself. So in conclusion, I've tended to think that the sense of life as a gift, a sense that I often feel, and the corresponding response of gratitude must, for an atheist, be a residue of a providential religious outlook, and perhaps it is. But I'm not so sure, really. The implication that one's life is a benefit to one is itself puzzling. The other side of the puzzle of whether being alive can be a bad thing for one. But whatever we should say about that, it's a further vexing thought that one should be thankful, as distinct from just glad, for this benefit. Thankful to what or to whom and under what conditions? It seems, I mean, that there are conditions seems obvious. It would be a further injury to the wretched of the earth to suppose that they should, despite it all, still regard their lives as a gift, or so it might seem. It may be that gratitude for life makes sense, if it makes sense at all, only as gratitude for a life of a particular kind, and that is worth living. That is in some way a wonderful thing. Perhaps we can't even make sense of this except in debunking terms. But again, I'm not so sure. Gratitude for life, if that's the right term, has what even some atheists have wanted to acknowledge as a spiritual dimension, a dimension that calls for a special sort of appreciation, perhaps something like reverence. As my wife Sarah pointed out to me the other day, the idea of a blessing belongs in this family of terms, and this deserves further investigation. But I'm on firmer, I think, and more mundane grounds when I say that I'm grateful for my life in philosophy, and that philosophy is a gift, for here there are identifiable benefactors. Others who have, as it were, given me philosophy, encouraged and sustained my participation, given me the benefit of their teachings or criticisms, or otherwise paid attention to my work, and not just teachers and colleagues, but also students. Even so, it's a striking feature of the phenomenon that gratitude is due to philosophical laborers one has never met and could never have met. I've never officially collaborated with anyone as a co-author. In that sense, I have had an especially solitary scholarly life. I'm not sure why. Nevertheless, all of us write for an audience and make ourselves answerable to them in accordance with the standards of our discipline. In that way, we're all collaborators. The boundaries between subfields and even between philosophy and other disciplines are permeable. A distinction drawn in epistemology may travel across currents of discourse to aesthetics or to cognitive science, where it may bear unintended fruit. There is a kind of community which philosophers share with each other as co-disciplinarians, and to benefit this discipline is to benefit each of its participants. So I am grateful to them all, even to Hegel. Yeah. And I'm grateful to the Dewey Prize Committee for the honor of the lecture today, and to all of you for coming. Thank you.